Thanks for coming to this series called The More You Know by as part of the Race Equality Week. This is our fourth talk of the session. And so anybody who knows, who's been to all the previous three, it's been quite interesting. And people have been using different formats of them, doing presentations. These sessions are recorded and they will be available on our YouTube channel. But also BCB Radio will be have a slot for us, and you will be able to play back. Amna wants this to be an interactive session, so please do, you know, ask questions. Feel free to have an open conversation. Everybody's opinions are vital. Let me just tell you a little bit about us. So we are Race Equality Network. We're an infrastructure organisation, and we work with issues around race throughout the Bradford district. Let me introduce you to our speaker, who is Amna Rahman. She's a research fellow at Born in Bradford and Bradford Teaching Hospitals NHS Trust, a foundation trust. The talk is titled Kashmir to Bradford, and Amna will outline her family history and migration from Azad Kashmir and some of the many achievements and contributions that the Kashmiri Bradfordians have contributed today. So I'll hand you over to Amna. And as I said, it's interactive. So please either use a chat box or feel free to speak to Amna directly.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everyone. As Adiba said, my name's Amna, and I'm a research fellow as my daytime post, but I have an interest just in general history and South Asian history, and there's personal relevance there for my own family coming from what we call Azad Kashmir, and some people call it Pakistan administered Kashmir. So I'll talk a little bit about that and a little bit about the community that's settled in the UK that originate from Azad Kashmir, and then I will add a little bit of background and context to it as well, but I'm hoping by the end of it, we'll be able to have a discussion around it, and I'm hoping it'll increase people's knowledge if you're not already aware, but I'm thinking one or two people will already have lots of knowledge around this anyway. So just bear with me while I talk, and then at the end I'll stop and we can shape it into a conversation. I'd like it to be as interactive as possible. So I just want to start off with a little bit of background and context. So the migration of mainly men from the northern parts of Pakistan and Azad Kashmir and Pakistan administered Kashmir to places like Bradford, it goes back to the sort of 1930s, when they first arrived on merchant navy ships. But then the vast migration that took place in the late 1950s and 60s was due to the Commonwealth citizens being invited to the UK here to work in the mills and other industries, because there was a production boom and demand couldn't be met with the indigenous workforce. So my father emigrated to the UK in the early 60s from a place called Panjeri, which is in Pimber Division, and it's sort of neighbouring Meadbur Division. But everybody who comes says they are from Azad Kashmir, it gets this title of all, they're automatically from Meadbur, but yet people don't realize there's about six or seven other districts attached to the Pakistan side of Kashmir where people come from to the UK or other places in Europe. So but unlike most of the people from the Meadbur division, my family weren't affected by the building of the Mangla Dam, which took place in the sort of late 50s and early 60s, but it submerged about 100 plus villages. So you can imagine there was massive upheaval and people were sort of uprooted from either being placed in other parts of Pakistan or Azad Kashmir, but a lot of them at the same time, because there was this invite to come to the UK and be a part of the workforce here. A lot of the younger men ended up coming here during that period. But in general, just like a lot of other South Asian minorities that came here. The intention was that they'd come here for maybe a few years, earn some money, improve their own life, but also improve the lives of the families that they left behind. But unfortunately, I mean, as history tells you, that didn't actually happen. So we have a community that's been settled here for about 60 plus years. But similar for my dad as well, he came with the intention of just staying here for a couple of years, earning some money, and then going back. But for my dad, I think his one of his primary motives was his health. He'd served in the British Indian Army during World War II, and then when Pakistan and India were created, partition took place. Our natural side of where my parents were all located based fell into the Pakistan side. So he then moved into the Pakistani army for a while, and then he actually took early retirement due to ill health. And so hence he came here. So you may have heard of something called the myth of return, which is what happened to a lot of South Asian people of that generation. They came here for a few years and hoping that the thinking was they'd go back. So, but obviously it didn't happen. And after that, then the families started to come. Originally, it was mainly young men who came, which is slightly different to other South Asian communities that have emigrated here, because some of them came whole with the whole families. But that, I think that took place later, and some of them came from other parts of the Indian subcontinent, so they came with their families. But for many people of that first generation, they'd experienced the trauma of partition, and obviously that was loss of a homeland. There was massive upheaval. You know, I think there was about 8 million people that ended up moving from within the Indian subcontinent to either from what is now India to Pakistan, from what is now Pakistan to India, and similar situation on the other side with what is Bangladesh. So there was massive kind of upheaval. So these people actually did endure a trauma. It wasn't something of their making, but, you know, affected the masses. But then for people of Azad Kashmir, I think the second trauma came of the building of the Mangla Dam, which obviously, like I said, you know, submerged more than 100 villages. So people were displaced and uprooted again. But for me, I think the third trauma came when these communities arrived here, because whilst work was plentiful, they were invited to come here and work. But there was also a lot of racism and prejudice around. You openly saw adverts asking for people to work, but it had things like no blacks, no Irish, and no dogs. So you were kind of putting people in the same category as dogs, and that was quite blatant. You know, people saw it in newspapers, job centers, etc. But the other thing that happened to them was that they came here as sort of mainly healthy young men, but, you know, there was a culture shock. They didn't know how the system worked. The language was a barrier for many, but also the cold, harsh conditions of, you know, what they've endured in terms of the climate and the landscape here. Whereas, you know, they came from a sunny and sort of a different place, rural backgrounds in the Indian subcontinent. So I think that left many of them feeling sort of disheartened and disorientated, and there was a willing, you know, a yearning to go back to the families. Obviously, they had a cut off. They were with the families in the first instance. Many young men left behind. If they were single, they had their birth families. If they were married, they had wives and children. So they had that to cope with. But then they also had this added experience of this exposure to this hostility and this negative kind of environment. I've actually quoted this in my book. I've written a memoir based on my late father's life and some of his experiences, which at the end, if we've got time, I'll read a little excerpt around this on it. But coming from sort of research background, I'm always interested in communities and the effects this kind of thing has. So there's something called a phenomenon known as the healthy migrant effect, which is basically says that when people migrate from one place to another, they're usually quite young, healthy and able-bodied, but as they come into a new country, depending on how, you know, what they experience, and often, you know, there's hardship and struggle and negativity attached to it, that health starts to deteriorate and it becomes, you know, at one time they're actually better than, in better health than the indigenous population, but then it deteriorates because of the what they've been experienced to. So things like poverty and having to sort of live on the breadline. So these sort of things add to health inequalities, you know, of living in poorer, dense, deprived neighbourhoods. But also, I mean, and that's been really made evident now in during this COVID pandemic, that you see that it's people at the poorer end of the socioeconomic status that have had the worst from it. So that's like a culmination of stuff that's been happening over history as well, and then things like this add to it. But the vast majority of people from Azad Kashmir had either little or no education. They came from sort of mainly poor working class farming backgrounds, and that's like a label that's kind of stuck to our community ever since. But that, you know, if we analyze it, the overall picture is different now. We have, I mean, if you take Mirpur City, for example, currently it's got two universities and several degree level colleges that are attached to the districts that adjoin it. So, you know, progression is there. So, but here in terms of what we have as the offsprings and subsequent generations of the first generation that arrived here, we've still got a lot of people who, although educationally they've excelled, but it's actually getting the jobs that match that education. So we still get people who, although they may have a degree, but they're still doing they're still in occupations or jobs that carry risks of exposure, like retail, hospitality, taxi driving, bus drivers. But at the same time, others have done remarkably well as well, which I think I'll touch upon in a little bit about some of the role models that we have here in the current community. But I think generally what I've discovered is that people from Azad Kashmir all get labelled as Mirpuri community, but there's also in my younger days I used to encounter this label called MPs, which was supposed to be Mirpuris in short, but it had sort of negative connotations attached to it. And probably I think what's happened is that traditionally that our communities have tended to be family focused, very sort of supportive of each other. So sometimes when they're criticized, people see them as sort of like stuck together and very close-knit communities, which are hard to penetrate, but and there's where there's little room for outsiders. But I used to personally wonder why that was so. Why were one community being sort of labeled like that? Yet I could see other communities that came from districts surrounding Mirpur district, which are in what we call proper Pakistan. And yet those people were labeled as Punjabis, where, and this community was being labeled like that. But I think when I've done some research, and I think this kind of explains why, because I think what happened with Mirpur division in pre-partition was that because it was Jammu and Kashmir, both were Muslim majority states, but they were ruled by a Hindu Maharaja. And that Dogra Maharaj, I've again done some research. It's the way they treat their citizens in general wasn't particularly kind. You know, they were quite dictatorial, and they basically they did a lot of. I think because they were backed by the British. I mean, that dynasty only lasted about 100 years or so, and it was actually they were basically Punjabis who had purchased the state of Jammu and Kashmir from the British. So they were kind of imposed on them as such, really. They weren't, you know, natives of Jammu and Kashmir. But the way they treat people in general was they used the old tactics of divide and rule. So they played communities up against each other, which I found, and Mirpur itself was one of those backwater kind of districts where there wasn't that much in terms of prosperity and opportunity for people. So I can see how people managed to sort of stick together, because if they've faced, if they've endured that kind of hardship right from the start, and so they've kind of stuck together as a community when they've come here as well. And this resonates with a lot of other newer communities. I see it in, say, the Eastern Europeans that are arriving, that have arrived in the UK in the last 10, 15 years. They're very close-knit as well. But that, I mean, I think people do it because of a support. It's a support network for them, and it's something, you know, that they've got to help each other with. But I also see that younger generations have endured this too. When I was younger, certainly in the generations before me, something called Paki bashing was quite common. And it wasn't just Pakistanis that were called Pakis. Anybody with a brown skin, Indian, Bangladeshi, Sri Lankan, whatever, they were all called that. And our older generations at the time discouraged any kind of retaliation. I mean, I was a kid then, but, you know, my older cousins, etc., they were sort of discouraged not to sort of take anything up, because I think at that time our communities were still establishing themselves, and they just wanted to make, you know, some base for themselves where they would be accepted and, you know, where they would be allowed to progress. But then I think from the late 1980s and early 90s, you saw this era of retaliation by youths from some of the South Asian communities, which, you know, you've probably all heard, where it led to incidents like the Bradford riots, etc. Yes, there were, I think there was a purpose where, you know, these youth became disorientated, very angry and wanted to lash out. But I think what they were also trying to say was make a statement of, we're not prepared to take this anymore. So, but at the same time, something that notice I call something called Paki power came, became a symbol as well. I particularly noticed that with when you saw the 1992 World Cup, Cricket World Cup, sorry, where, you know, Paki power was being advertised on TV and stuff, you know, as a positive thing. It was so I think from that, the youth were able to take up something that as a symbol of sort of pride, resistance, and much more. And alongside that, what we've seen since is the word Mirpuri attached to language, like say Mirpuri language. Yeah, it's actually no different to the Potwari dialect of Punjabi, and that's spoken in like the northern parts of Pakistan, like Rawalpindi and Gujarhan, Jhelum, north areas of Jhelum. It's actually a dialect, but I think the word Mirpuri has been attached to it in for a lot of reasons, for people see it as a separate language, but where it's actually not. Lots of food, Mirpuri food. I mean, most of the restaurants and takeaways in Bradford are actually owned by people of Azad Kashmir origin, like the restaurants like the Karachi and the Kashmir that were opened in the 1950s. Again, the families from Kashmir. Mirpuri jewelry, Mirpuri clothing, and I can't actually see any difference to that compared to others, but I think it's a symbolic gesture. It's a connotation of a community that's taking pride in its existence and is actually doing like trying to label something positive towards this. So children like myself, I didn't know much about all this stuff. I think I led a fairly sheltered life. You know, all this came into light much later on in the years that were kind of, I think maybe my late teens and early 20s. But in terms of us as a people, I think Mirpurs and people from Azad Kashmir, northern parts of Pakistan, generally very friendly, hospitable, generous, the genuine, quite simple people as well at heart. But I mean, for example, if you went to a Mirpur region these days and you ask somebody for directions, most likely they'll ask you to come and have a cup of tea with them or have some, you know, something to eat with them. That's how they are compared to, I can know other regions of Pakistan where people have said, oh, well, we've asked people for directions and they've just given us a long route and basically just sent us around the housing just as a prank. But this is like the sort of difference that I think people from Azad Kashmir have. Just sort of typical of that family, even here, if we have say, workmen, for example, in our houses, we'll offer them food, tea, samosas, that kind of thing. And that usually they'll compliment that, because not every community does that. And they sort of say, oh, well, you know, we go into lots of houses, but we don't always get this kind of treatment. But that's just something that we do as a to respect our guests. It's a cultural thing, I think. And besides, I think we have, I think it's just something that we do as something that you can take for sort of granted with, certainly with our older generations. I mean, the younger generations are doing things slightly differently now. But so that's sort of what I mean by when people are sort of quite genuine and generous and caring. So just kind of fast forward about 60 years to where we are now as a community. We've excelled, I mean, people have excelled in business, management, law, there's clinicians, medical people, media, academia, politics, sports, and so forth. But yet we're still sort of underrepresented in many of the professions and possible lines of for jobs, etc., that kind of thing. But yet we have some really positive role models right from the start. I mean, say, like, most of you'll probably know this anyway, but Mohammed Ajib, for example, was the first Asian Lord Mayor in the UK. We have people at a local level, like we have our local MPs, Naz Shah, Imran Hussain. I mean, politics may be different, but just giving examples as people, sport people like Adil Rashid, businesses, we have like restaurants like Mumtaz, which are world famous. We have people in the media like Sabir Pervez, Look North, so many more younger people as examples that are leading the way in our communities. But I think that's really a positive thing, because I mean, 60 years isn't a really huge amount of time when you think about it for a community to start from scratch to where it is now. And this will probably be the same for other South Asian communities as well. But I think for younger people, it's really great that they've got these role models, because my generation, we didn't have any of this. So, but firstly, I mean, people can relate to these people. There's somebody who looks and talks like them, but they also understand the plight and culture and how family and religion and everything works. So youngsters can have people as icons and beacons of progression. But what I think also, from talking to people, I've realized that nothing's landed on people's plates, you know, easily. Everybody that's been mentioned, and all the others, the people that I haven't mentioned, have had to get this through sheer work, hard work and determination. So youngsters, again, can have pick something from that and take something about future planning in terms of how they're going to do it as well. But I think also what's kind of quite evident now is integration, which like I said, I had quite a sheltered kind of upbringing, and my generation didn't really sort of go further than the Asian, South Asian communities. I had white friends as well, but they were mainly because of the schools that I went to. We didn't have the sort of mixing, probably because I lived in a predominantly inner city Asian area, and I was sent to school in a predominantly white British area, where most of the children were of white British backgrounds. And so it was, you know, we made friends, and some of those have sort of carried on to this day. Whereas youngsters, they've got much more, I see it as they're mixing much more. Yet some would say, oh, we've got these segregated cities, and we've got, you know, I've even heard people say that there's no-go areas of Bradford, but I don't think, I don't actually believe in that. Yes, there's areas that are maybe rough compared to others, but I don't really see what they're classed as no-go. Probably segregation a little bit, because communities have tended to stick to their own traditionally, but I see youngsters moving on and flying the nest. Some, you know, even in terms of marriage and mixing, you see lots of youngsters from Azad Kashmir origins marrying into other South Asian communities, whereas at one time we didn't see much of that. There's just being able to get out into the workplace and progress. So, you know, they're being exposed to much more. So that was just my brief kind of introduction talk as to my community. But what I wanted to ask people was, sort of thinking about your knowledge previously and thinking about now, if this has made any kind of, has it made you aware of anything? Has it flagged things up for you that you want to sort of explore further and ask questions? Or if you are from that community, from the Azad Kashmir community, do you think as a result of listening to what I've said, has that made any difference or impact or something that you can that you might be able to use to contribute to in the future? So I just wanted to open it up as a discussion first of all, and then maybe towards the end have some actions that you might want to take away from today and get involved. It could be something quite simple with maybe learning about history or getting more involved in a cause, or even just thinking that you're going to try and mix with more people from this community and have certain actions that you might want to take forward. So I'll pass the floor sort of thing back to you and see, ask for your comments and feedback so far.
Is anyone who wants to ask a question? Yeah, Haksha?
That was a lovely talk. Thank you, Aman. I just wanted to ask, when you were talking about Azad Kashmir and Pakistan, do you class yourself Pakistani or do you class yourself as Kashmiri? I just got there, the way you were talking about Kashmir a lot, and you were sort of comparing that with Pakistani. Where would you, what would you call yourself?
I class myself both as Kashmiri and Pakistanis, I think, because the way things are here in this community, it's, I mean, yes, Kashmiri is a separate identity as well, but generally you tend to be classed as Pakistani. I mean, now in the census and things, you can or any forms, you can actually you know, if says if your ethnicity is Asian, you can put you can tick the other and tick Kashmiri, but Pakistani is there. So I think they're interchangeable because of language, culture, etc. But also origins of people from I think mainly from the Azad Kashmir side, they tend to be more linked with Punjabis, whereas the Kashmiris in Srinagar or places like that, they tend to have a Kashmiri ethnicity, which is kind of dominant in that area. So they're not they've not necessarily had any. I mean, some of them have. Some of them have. Many have roots elsewhere. But yeah, there is a sort of a difference in that way. So I just align myself with either Kashmiri or Pakistani. I just usually, if you say Pakistani, and then people will say, "What part are your family from?" And then I would say Azad Kashmir, which is. But then that will just get interpreted as Mirpur, whereas in Azad Kashmir there are seven other districts that people originate from as well. But I think that's because predominantly the people in the UK are from and particularly in a city like Bradford are from Mirpur district.
Thank you. And just to add that when I did my talk on Tuesday, my family from India, they actually went to Asia, to Africa first, and then they came from Africa to England. So your story mainly is Kashmiri people came directly to UK, yeah. They didn't go to Africa. So a lot of the difference between a lot of our communities is we actually went to Africa first in the late 30s and then we came to England. So that was the difference between. So
can I ask you a question? When somebody asks you what ethnicity are you, what do you say?
I'm very proud to be Hindu. So I'm a Hindu. When my parents are from Gujarat, but they went to Africa. So I was born in Kenya, so I should be really Kenyan. But I'm very proud of my culture, so I'm a very proud Hindu. So yeah, that's me.
No, that's fine. I was thinking of geography because, I mean, I'm a proud Muslim as well. But do you say, like, I'm Gujarati Kenyan, or do you say I'm Indian Gujarati?
I'm Indian. Indian. Gujarat is just one of the states in India.
Yeah, people use it because obviously Gujarat has its own language, culture. I mean, a lot of people here, I'd say Bangladeshis will say we're Bengali, but a lot of them, because they come from Sylhet, they'll say I'm Sylheti. And then you have people like Gujarati, Punjabi, and similar with Pakistan as well. Some people, if they're from Punjab, they'll say I'm Punjabi. But as we'll say, we're from Azad Kashmir. But yeah, it's funny. It's kind of how Well, we are who we are, aren't we? So it's basically,
No, I you know, like, you know, I'm from Indian, so it's because of my parents' culture, what they brought me up with, their their characteristics, etc. So I've, you know, I'm very proud to. I've, obviously, I've been in this country. It's just similar to you, you know, for over 50 years. So yeah, I'm proud to be Indian. That's it. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that talk. I just wanted to come and ask if there's any sort of specific Kashmiri support centre or community centre or where people can come together and talk about their heritage and share knowledge and food, etc. Is there anything like that in Bradford?
I don't think there's one sort of specific just for Kashmiris, but if you have anything Pakistani attached to it, the culture and everything's very similar. So most of us would just go to something that has, say, Pakistani attached to it. Some food restaurants, most of the restaurants here are, although they're owned by people from Azad Kashmir, but I mean, it gets classed as Indian food because that's the, you know, like curries, etc. It's just the labels that are attached to it. But yeah, it's generally, I think if you went somewhere to a gathering and you spoke to people, chances are that predominantly people will be from Azad Kashmir in Bradford.
Thank you. The reason I ask is because I work for Diabetes UK, and diabetes is really prevalent in the South Asian community, Black African and Caribbean as well. And we're running a webinar for diabetes in Ramadan next week. So maybe it'd be good if you wanted me to send across that information, and it might be helpful to anyone here or any of your contacts if you wanted to come along. You'll hear from people from the community with lived experience of diabetes, people that choose to fast, people that choose not to fast, etc. You'll hear from an Islamic scholar and from the healthcare professional from a Muslim background as well. So I'll make sure you get that. And if you've got any questions, feel free to. Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a question. Was the third generation, so basically people who have migrated from Kashmir, what is the identity of the third generation? Do they feel more Kashmiri, or they feel Pakistani? I mean, like the mix of Punjab and all the, like a Pakistani identity, or do they feel alien from their entire culture and identity? I'm talking about the culture, not the religion or nationality or that sort.
I think they would say they were Pakistani stroke Kashmiri if it was in terms of a culture ethnicity, but most of them tend to sort of align themselves as British Asian, which is a broader kind of identity. But yeah, there's I mean, people know their roots, they know their history, generally they tend to know their history, and but as integration and progression happens in this country, it's each generation loses a little bit. I mean, even with myself being like from different to my parents, my the next generations after me are slightly different. We're into our fourth generations in some families, and again, some of them are different. So the culture changes slightly. I think they're adapting more and more of
to the host community, basically.
I think, yeah, but I think with a sort of broader awareness, knowledge and everything, people are being influenced by different things as well. So some youngsters, you know, they incorporate all sorts into their identity, which can be some of religion, can be culture, and it can be nationality, etc. But yeah, it's kind of developing in different ways. But I think the core root of it is that if you... You see, that one of the questions that you, we as, I think, Asian people, I particularly not in this country, but I've noticed it abroad, is that they'll say, oh, where are you from? And if you say the UK, then the next question will be, well, but where are you originally from? Because of your colour and your attire and everything. So if that something like that was posed, people do tend to say, well, yes, it's, you know, I'm Pakistani Kashmiri or Kashmiri Pakistani.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll sort of ask, and when you were talking about when our parents first came over, I'll just tell you exactly. My father's side originates from Srinagar, So they're from Kashmir. And my mum was from Azad Kashmir, and they settled in Gujahan. And my dad, when he first came over, he left with a degree in economics from the University of Lahore. And just going back to the racism that some of our families experienced, my father is, he passed away now, but when you see him, you couldn't distinguish between him and a white person, basically. There was no difference, you couldn't tell. And I remember him telling me that when he first came here, like you said, that there was the job market was the reason that people came. And he started working on the buses. And I remember him telling me, I said to him, you know, what was the interview process like? And he said to me, basically, they used to get a bus full of white people. And then anyone that was not white would have to parade up and down on the bus. And they felt that their interaction with the residents on the bus was okay. If they thought, yeah, you know, this guy's okay, then they'd give him the job. Mm-hmm. And if they felt that because of the colour of their skin or their tone of their language, if the residents of the bus thought, no, you know, we don't really like him, they wouldn't get the job. Mm-hmm. And that's how, and my father got the job because he didn't look Asian. And it wasn't until he was given the job when they, you know, had to give him his name. And he's got a typical Abdul Rashid name. So there were things like that really, to me, was really shocking.
Yeah.
But again, it's just that whole thing about people presuming you're of a particular heritage because of the colour of your skin. And just one question, really. So because my dad's from Kashmir, his language is different. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I know you said you speak Midbri, but are there any other languages in Azad Kashmir that you speak?
I think it's mainly the Potwari Punjabi dialect, which is same as is spoken in Gujarhan and Pindi, you know, those areas as well. But further up into what is like Srinagar, obviously they speak there's the Kashmiri dialect, but there's also the Dogri, the other language. I think maybe the where the line of control is, the split between Indian and Pakistani Kashmir, that's where they're probably different, slight that Dogri language and other languages are spoken. But generally, in I think Azad Kashmir, it's Punjabi, and then Urdu is the official language.
Okay, and then just my last question, which is probably a bit controversial, but what does Azad Kashmir think of the conflict on the other side of the border?
I think there are people that have been divided, haven't they? They'd like to be together as one, as what they were pre-partition. And obviously in Azad Kashmir, it has its own assembly, legislature. It has, you know, the articles, like, is it 3 or 5 and article something that was withdrawn on the Indian administered. Azad Kashmir still has those intact, so nobody from Pakistan can buy property in Azad Kashmir. People from Azad Kashmir can go into Pakistan, but not the other way. So in that way, it's we don't see the struggle, you know, like the heavy buildup of army or anything like that. It's just quite a peaceful place generally. But as people, you know, there's families that are divided because of a geographical line that's not actually there, but it's, and, you know, people have... and they've been divided for a few generations. So you see the hurt, and you want people, they want to be together and be able to just mix with each other freely. But until this is sorted, it's going to be, I suppose it's going to stay like this for some period. But yeah, I think both sides on the will, there's, you know, there's a will on both sides in terms of people that they want to be together and have that opportunity, have that chance, whatever the UN plebiscite offered them to be able to decide for themselves.
Amanda?
So I feel like I've learned a lot today, and there's some things I'd like to read into a bit more about. But something I didn't quite understand, you talked about earlier about, I think you rephrased it as the myth of return, about how people came over here with the idea they'd probably stay here for a couple of years, earn some money, and then go back home again. So what I didn't understand is could they not go home because of things that had happened here? Could they not go home because of things that had changed politically back home? Were they prevented by those things? So yeah, I just didn't understand what the reason was as to why people couldn't go home.
Yeah, I think probably what happened was that because what they'd planned initially was that they'd work for a few years, make enough money and things would improve, but it didn't quite happen like that. And then as more people came and they settled, on the one hand, you started to get this community that started to emerge, services started to emerge for this, so that they were able to invite their families over as well. And then families with children, education, etc., people, you know, that started. So, you know, people didn't want to uproot them again. But also, I think the people that were left behind, although initially they were reliant, they still are to some extent, of the money that goes back to the those communities. I mean, each immigrant community does this. You know, they settle themselves and make they better themselves, but they also better the people that they've left behind as well. So things started to progress for them as well. So I think, I'll give you an example. My parents actually decided that they were going to move back to Pakistan in the early 70s, when my brother and I were just babies, basically. But they stayed there for a few years. And I think things don't work out unless you have something that's really stable in terms of income, etc. You know, you naturally become driven back to this country because of all the services, like health service, for example. I mean, yes, they have health services there, but they're not, you know, for its faults, whatever, the NHS still is great, and you don't get this in anywhere else in the world. But yeah, I've known families that have actually gone and they've stayed there for about 30 plus years and then still come back here, because sometimes it's higher education for the children that that's driven them back. Sometimes it's just subsequent generations wanting to come, you know, live back here. So it's like, I've never known anybody who's gone back and stayed there permanently. They've all, you know, come back for visits, extended visits, or come back to settle here. So it must be just the way things have worked out. But I think it's, you know, it probably became a bit impossible to do that after the first 10 years of settlement here.
We've got a question in the chat. Says the majority who were impacted by Mangala Dam project, wouldn't they have lost their homes due to the project?
Yes, they, when I said there were 100 villages that were submerged, they went underwater to make that dam. So those people were displaced in, some of them were, they still had their own family connections and land in other parts of Azad Kashmir. So they moved there, but some of them were rehoused in other parts of like the Punjab in Pakistan. So, but a lot of them, some of them came here as well. But what I've seen is that a lot of those families have also brought properties in the actual Mirpur city of today. So some of them haven't gone far, you know, maybe a few miles, etc. But there was that upheaval and lifting of, basically they had to uproot from their places of where the, you know, families had been there for generations. In the summer, when the water levels are lowered in the dam, you see the taller roofs of the taller buildings, like there's a church spire that comes up somewhere in the middle of the dam. And there's other buildings that you can see that have just been submerged under that water.
Fatma, did you have a question?
Hi, Amna. Thank you for the amazing talk. I actually listened to you speak, I think it was in South Asian Heritage Month a while back.
Okay.
I recently read a very good article by a Palestinian journalist on the loss of a homeland. Mm-hmm. And he talked about, he grieved his two grandmothers who had recently passed away, not in Palestine, but in Jordan. And in recent times, many academics have kind of compared the issue in Palestine and Kashmir being, you know, the cycle of violence, colonization, and just like, yeah, the ongoing cycle of like discrimination and occupation. But he touched on the notion of a homeland. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, for you, what does a homeland mean? And I think, yeah, just what does the notion of a homeland mean to you, and what does it mean to Kashmiris generally? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it means belonging to a land and a people where you're able to sort of decide freely of your own will, you know, within the majority's opinion, just like we have here. But for many, I think we've now become sort of dual heritage as well. So I have, personally, I feel this is my homeland. Britain is homeland. And yes, I'll go over to Kashmir, and I still have lots of family there, lots of connections. But there's a little bit of a disconnect. But for Kashmiris that are living in Jammu and Kashmir at the moment, I think it means belonging to a nation and having a right up, and they're saying it, and how it's ruled and governed without the external forces that are both India and Pakistan having their kind of control on them.
Okay, so come towards like the end of the talk, Amna. Is there anything that the theme is actions, not words? Mm-hmm. And is there anything that you would recommend the attendees today, that you recommend that they do to increase their knowledge or to learn a little bit more about Azad Kashmir?
Or Kashmir in general, I would say contact people, read if you can, and look it up, look at the history, and speak to people like myself. And there's lots of people from Srinagar and other areas of Kashmir settled in these in Yorkshire, West Yorkshire. Speak to them, you get a perspective of what it's like, and you know what it's, and the differences between the two sides as well. But yeah, I'm happy to speak to people about it further. And but maybe I think if people can look it up and read and kind of you know get be more interested in it, that would be great. Could I read that expert that I was saying from my book about my dad's experiences?
Yeah.
I mean, hear about what I meant about the racism and stuff, if that's okay. That's great, thank you. Okay, so I'm just gonna, okay, you know, when I said people were quite simple Kashmiri people, and because most of them people came from rural backgrounds, it was all very new to them, all this coming into from rural backgrounds into industrialized cities and having to get used to it, etc. So although my dad, I mean, he was a bit of a global citizen in that he'd been to about 16 different countries whilst he was serving under the in the Indian Army under the British. But just simple things like, I'll just read you a little bit and then I'll move on to something else. Arriving here, this is about Heathrow. I arrived at Heathrow and then caught the train to Bradford with my brother-in-law. He was very, very young, age 21 years, and it was his first experience of travel outside Pakistan. We were both on the train from London to Bradford. It was heated. I had been on trains before, but not one that had been that had heat. We could not figure out where the heat was coming from at first. Then my brother-in-law asked, "Do you think the train's on fire?" I mean, so simple stuff. Lots of families will have had little stories like that, you know, just simple things that you think, but that's how it was then. And then I'm just going to read about about the stuff I was talking about, racism and what have you. Life in England was very tough for the first 10 years or so until our communities became established. For those first few years, work was plentiful and many of us lived in small houses which were overcrowded. Some of us would sleep during the day whilst others worked, and then we would work night shifts whilst others slept in the same beds. This is probably where we picked up the label of being dirty. The English people thought Asians were dirty. Some of the men probably were, but not everyone was like that. So not like so, but we all got stereotyped. In fact, it was us who were struggling to get used to the new way of life. We were used to washing our bodies down with clean water, and here people were fortunate if they had a bathtub to wash in. A lot of the houses did not have bathtubs. Some houses had water taps in certain sections of the house where people could wash. A lot of people had to use communal baths to wash properly. I remember some of my relatives who lived in places like Bury in Greater Manchester having to share communal toilets with other people who lived on the same street. They used to have to take their toilet paper with them. Work was plenty, was easy to find in those days, even though some mills had notices up saying no blacks. All people of colour were labelled as blacks. There were plenty of jobs. You could leave one job in the morning and be hired again in the afternoon at another place. My generation's experience of racism and prejudice in this country was blatantly stark. We did not like it. It was hurtful. How could people who ruled our countries not so long ago behave like this towards us? Soldiers like me who had served with British servicemen. Why was this happening and why were we so different now? Most of the men were young, healthy, able, and who came to work and were prepared for any kind of work. However, what we were not prepared for was either being given the cold shoulder, experiencing hostility and being seen as inferior. It was disheartening, demoralizing. We could not comprehend why it was like this, as we were not taking anyone's jobs. We just wanted to make an honest living and fit in. It left many feeling low in mood and self-worth, yearning to go back home. The loneliness and being far away from our birth families was difficult to cope with, but the hostile environment and the damp, cold weather just added to the anguish. Yeah, I'll stop there, but that's, it gives you a bit of a sort of snippet of what it was like for people of that generation. And that probably wasn't just people from Azad Kashmir, it was probably all people of colour who settled here. Okay.
Okay, Amna, thank you so much. It's been really interesting. Yeah,